Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why focusing on screen time may not be the most important thing for parents to focus on with their teens.
And what could end Vice President Kamala Harris's honeymoon as the Democratic National Convention kicks off this week?
But first, last year, Arizona became a leader in psychedelic research for treatment for things like PTSD and pain management when the legislature allocated $5 million to research whole mushroom therapy. The Scottsdale Research Institute and the University of Arizona will carry out the studies once they get FDA approval. But just last week, the FDA declined to approve the psychedelic drug MDMA for treatment for PTSD, requesting more research be done. It was seen as a major setback for advocates who saw it as a potential breakthrough moment for psychedelics into mainstream medicine. But our next guest is one of the researchers who sees the potential in psychedelics, and she doesn't see it as a setback. Dr. Sue Sisley is president and principal investigator of the Scottsdale Research Institute, and she told me she thinks it should make people like her work harder to do this kind of research right. I spoke with her recently about where her state-funded research stands and what's next for psychedelic treatment.
We're hoping to understand more about how natural psilocybin mushrooms work, because what's happened is there's a ton of hype around psilocybin in general. But if people look closely at the studies, they'll see that they're actually just studying one molecule out of this very complex mushroom that actually is loaded with dozens of different alkaloids and tryptamines that all are exerting different effects on the human body. So we want to study the real world mushrooms that people are actually using underground and be able to learn more about how they work and don't work. So we're going to be publishing both the good and the bad about these mushrooms, which is different than big pharma studies. A lot of people are not aware that there's never been a single study anywhere in the world looking at whole natural psilocybin mushrooms. Hmm. There's a lot of enthusiasm around psilocybin as a potential medicine. And you saw we even passed a bill in the legislature this last session that would have created a treatment program around psilocybin. But it's a little premature because we still don't have any initial data on how natural psilocybin mushrooms affect humans.
Okay, so that's where your research fits into all of this. Do you have any preliminary results? Obviously, you must think this is promising to be doing this kind of research, and I know you've done research on the same kind of effects for cannabis in the past. What are you seeing? What are your hopes?
Well, we hope that we'll be able to understand more about how this can work for treating both pain and trauma, like post-traumatic stress disorder. So our study is going to be specifically looking at patients with life-threatening illness. Mm-hmm. These studies actually usually take years to get approval. And I'm hoping that the FDA will feel the amount of public pressure and enthusiasm around psilocybin and will hopefully move more quickly to greenlight this study by the end of the year.
But there was just a setback in this, right? Just late last week, the FDA rejected MDMA, one of these psychedelic drugs, for PTSD treatment, saying they need to see more research. It was widely seen as a pretty big blow to, you know, people who are pushing for this to be legalized and studied. It would have been a pretty breakthrough decision if the FDA had allowed it, it sounds like. Tell me your reaction.
Yeah, I think the biggest concern is that there was a lot of overhyping of MDMA and psychedelics in general. And a lot of people, when they talk about MDMA, are often omitting the risks of these drugs. And so we have to get back to the rigorous science. We need to be humble and really try to dig into the design of the studies and make sure that they're properly organized in a way that will appeal to the FDA and show them that we're doing the highest kind of gold standard controlled trials and that there's no sloppiness. I think the reality is that this fight, you know, this psychedelic movement is not just a scientific battle, but it's also a cultural and political struggle. You know, people fear what they don't understand. Mm-hmm. And I'm neutral scientist. I don't have any dog in this fight. I just want to see good data collected and published and, you know, go through peer review and make sure that we're putting forward the most accurate information for the public to scrutinize. I'm hoping that this doesn't deter people. This decision should actually enliven the research and motivate us to double down and be even more fervent about doing good quality research that is reliable. And hopefully that's what you're going to see going forward. This is really generational work, you know?
Yeah. Let me ask you about the downside there, like the risks, the concerns that people have and that the FDA panel that led up to this rejection of this MDMA treatment had. Like, they talked about things like abuse of the drugs, heart problems, injury. What are the risks involved from your point of view, at least based on what you've seen in your research?
Yeah. Well, the cardiac risks were not fully vetted. So that is something they need to explore more intensively in these next trials. Certainly, anytime you go under a drug and you're being guided by a therapist, you have to hope that that therapist is ethical and not a predator. And it's very difficult when you're dealing with human beings. You really don't know how they will behave. And we hope that people will adhere to the proper, you know, professional standards, but it is very concerning. And so I'm hoping in these next rounds of studies on psychedelics that we will find ways to minimize the role of the therapists when people are under the influence of these medicines, because people are very vulnerable during that time and they can be put in harm's way by bad actors. But yeah, it's bottom line though is all drugs, all medicines, even the ones that are FDA approved, all have risks and benefits. These psychedelics clearly have great medical potential, but we have to learn to harness them and minimize those side effects or threats and to enable them to finally be legally available on the market.
So let me ask you about the big picture here, which you mentioned a little bit earlier as well. But I mean, in terms of these broader efforts by researchers like you who believe in the potential of these kinds of treatments, like, where do you think we are, especially given this most recent FDA decision? Like, where do you think we are in terms of getting psychedelics into the medical mainstream and using them for the potentials they may be, you know, really helpful for?
Well, I think the best laboratories we're seeing are the states. You know, you're already seeing Oregon psilocybin program underway for a year, and they've treated over 5,000 patients, and it seems to be fairly successful, although sadly, they never implemented a registry to actually document the good and the bad of that program. So that was a huge miss. But luckily, the Colorado program is about to go live in January. And I happen to sit on the state commission in Colorado that's building the regulations around that program. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that that is a very comprehensive, solid framework that I think other states will want to emulate. Luckily, the philanthropists are not waiting for the government to step in. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of charitable donations coming into various universities and nonprofit organizations to start conducting the work, because they know it's going to take time for the government to step forward. But that's what's so impressive about Arizona authorizing this funding. You know, in the face of a huge state budget deficit, these elected officials chose to still stabilize that $5 million to be able to be the first state in the country to conduct natural psilocybin mushroom research. And I think that is so commendable that our state sees the potential of this medicine, but also wants to lead with the science first rather than creating some kind of state marketplace prematurely.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Sue Sisley, president and principal investigator of the Scottsdale Research Institute, joining us. Dr. Sisley, thank you for coming on. Thanks for explaining this to us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Lots of parents spend lots of time worrying about how long their kids are spending on screens and what they're doing while on their phones or other devices. But many parents are less certain about what they should do about that and how they should talk to their teens about what they're seeing online. But Tao Ha says it's important for parents to stay engaged. She's an associate professor in the psychology department at ASU and joins me to talk more about this. And Tao, what kinds of conversations do you hear between parents and their teens about phone use and how teens want to use their devices more than their parents want them to, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so teens typically want to use their phones all the time. And parents are trying to limit their screen time on their phones. But what we're also hearing a lot is that teens actually themselves have a lot of questions about, like, what does it mean? All the things that I see on my phone, like, what are these messages mean? And so, and they sometimes feel like the parents or adults in their life don't always understand what it is that they're going through. And also, like, they can't always talk about it because they feel like their parents don't have the technology knowledge.
Hmm. So are kids questioning stuff, for example, they see on social media, things like that? They don't really understand what it is they're seeing?
Yes. And this mostly has to do with the interpersonal world. So my research is mostly on teenagers and their relationships with parents and friends and romantic partners. And so most of their social interactions are online these days and are less so face-to-face. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of miscommunication when interactions are only online. And so often they will get messages or they see things online and they're just confused about what it means.
Well, and when teens think that their parents or adults in their life maybe aren't equipped to help them, is it because the parents don't understand the technology or they maybe don't understand the specifics of what, you know, a friend or romantic partner is messaging them?
I think it's both. Maybe it's mostly the second portion of your answer. So it's maybe that they don't understand the specific intentions of the partner. But I think there is a disconnect sometimes between how teens would like to talk about social media use and how parents are talking about it.
Well, it's interesting because I think for a lot of parents, the assumption is that their teens don't want to talk about it at all. And therefore, you know, in an attempt to, you know, not have unpleasant interactions with their kids, just don't bring it up. But what you're saying is their teens really do want to talk about it, at least in certain situations.
Yes, in certain situations when they are asking for it. And so I think parents are mostly concerned about monitoring their screen time and, you know, tracking where their child are. But I think what I hear from our teens who we interview and we do surveys with, like, they mostly have questions about, like, okay, I'm in love with this person. And right now this person is not in the location that they're supposed to be. What does it mean? It makes me feel really, really insecure about the relationship. And I don't know how to react right now. I think that's more the kind of support that teens are looking for that is not always available to them.
Well, it seems as though even if, like, for example, you know, parents who are in their 30s or 40s might not have the specific language or knowledge about, like, location sharing and stuff like that, the overarching picture, I would imagine, a lot of parents probably are able to at least talk about.
Exactly. And I think that's a really important point that you're making. And it's something that parents are actually not talking about because they're so focused on things like screen time. And they're not so focused on what is happening on their phones. But I actually think that you're absolutely right. It's so important that we talk with our children about what's actually happening on their phones instead of only trying to monitor their phone use.
And I would imagine that making it not so punitive is probably also important here, right? So the teen knows that, hey, if I have a question, even if I'm maybe looking at something I shouldn't be looking at or using my phone when I shouldn't be using it, if I have a question or a concern, I can go to my parents and they're not going to freak out on me.
Exactly. Yes. So, you know, a lot of parents and they have taking the phone away as a parenting strategy. Mm-hmm. And that's awful to an adolescent because you're cutting them off of the one thing that they care most about. And it's basically the whole, you know, you're cutting them off, not just from the phone, but of their entire social world. And adolescents are social beings. And that's the one thing that they really, really care about. So we've heard from teens, like, you know, they are afraid that if they do disclose or they do talk to their parents about things that have happened on their phone, that then their phone is being taken away. And so that's kind of counterproductive in many ways to just take their the child's phone away.
So do you think that parents are wrong to be thinking about screen time, or is it just they can't only think about screen time?
So when we think about screen time, we're the current scientific literature and also, you know, in a public discourse, there's been a lot of discussion about screen time and mental health problems and whether screen time is causing mental health problems. I think in the science field, we agree that the question is not that simple. And the evidence is also very unclear. So it's not really about like more or less screen time. It's more about like, when is this screen time happening? Is it happening just right before they go to bed and then they get distracted and are on YouTube or TikTok for like 3 hours and then go to bed way late, right? So then screen time is not so helpful. And it also gets away from us discussing like that what is happening on the screen is much more important than the screen time itself. I do think that the discussion can be more nuanced than just screen time.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, how much of all of this comes down to parents being open to having these conversations and maybe learning about the kinds of technology and platforms that their teenagers are using, and maybe even to an extent being a little vulnerable and acknowledging, hey, I don't really understand everything you're talking about, but I understand how people work. And, you know, here's sort of the guidance that I can offer you on this.
I think that's incredibly important. And I think it's for parents also, like, you don't have to understand every latest emoji or every latest platform or how everything works, or you don't have to monitor every single thing that your child is doing on their phone, because it's truly impossible. But yeah, I think it's exactly like you said, you know, you do have insights into like what your child needs and hopefully what is healthy communication. And so that's super important to communicate with your child. And I also think that one thing that we don't often talk enough about, we point a finger to teens and their social media use, but parents are also not always the most healthy users of social media. And so there's also a lot that we as parents can do in terms of setting an example. And we often hear that from teens, like, well, actually my parents are on their phone all the time too. Like, they don't want to be disturbed while they're scrolling on their phones. So, you know, I think that we can also look at our own behaviors.
Okay, that is Tao Ha, an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at ASU. Thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your time. Bye-bye.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we'll hear about the band Blind Pilot's latest album release, their first in 8 years.
But first,
Democrats from around the country are converging in Chicago this week at the Democratic National Convention to formally nominate Vice President Kamala Harris at the top of the Democratic ticket. It represents a dramatic turn from where the party was just a few weeks ago, before President Biden stepped aside. He's expected to kick off the convention tonight. But our next guest says pro-Palestinian protesters there could end the Harris honeymoon. Phil Boas is a columnist with the Arizona Republic, and he joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about it all. Good morning, Elvia. Phil?
Good morning.
All right. So, Elvia, I want to start with you and kind of set up the DNC in Chicago for us. Like, what does this moment represent to the Democratic Party, given what has just happened in the last, you know, several weeks? Even polling numbers are looking good for Kamala Harris. Her rallies are packed. They're talking about joy. This has been quite a honeymoon.
Yeah, it has been. But you know what? At this point, I don't think it's a honeymoon. I would call it that if the polls were flat or if Kamala Harris was behind, but she's not. So yes, this is going to be a huge party for Democrats. And you're correct that this is a very, very different party from a few weeks ago, where Democrats were calling on Biden to step down, to step aside. And he did. And he opened the door for Kamala Harris. And now, you know what I see? You know, I see Democrats now that are disciplined, they are orderly, and they have united, you know, behind Harris, who's making history, you know, as the first Black and South Asian person to lead a major ticket. So it is an important moment.
Okay, so let's turn to you then, Phil. You say there is something that could end this honeymoon phase for Harris. We saw a preview of it even when she was here in Glendale not too long ago, of pro-Palestinian protesters at her rally here. What happened then?
Well, what happened was that there was a disturbance in the crowd, and it was small, and it was the pro-Palestinian faction within the Democratic Party or on the left side of American politics. And the crowd very quickly shut them down, but they're back and they're already protesting in Chicago, and they're going to be a challenge for the Democrats. And we could talk about that a little more, but getting to something that Elvia said, and I agree with her, the honeymoon is over. And I'm not sure that a lot of people noticed it. The honeymoon with the national media ended on Thursday, Friday. Kamala Harris presented her economic plan. She came out of the cocoon for a few hours and laid down this plan for price controls on groceries. And it landed with a thud, with all of the national platforms that Democrats trust were coming out and really ridiculing this plan that she had put out. One of the first out of the chute was the Washington Post. Their editorial board panned it as gimmicks, but a really powerful column by the Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell. She came out and said it is hard to exaggerate how bad this policy is. She said, if your opponent claims you're a communist, maybe don't start with an economic agenda that can accurately be labeled as federal price controls. And then others piled on after that. And this is not the conservative press. This isn't Fox News. These are the New York Times, the Washington Post, the people that Democrats generally trust.
Let me get your take there, Elvia. I mean, like, how big of an impact do you think that kind of messaging, the kind of lack of press conferences that Harris is doing, the sort of slow rollout, as Phil's kind of pointing out there, of real policy from the campaign? Is this going to be a problem if she doesn't speed this up and sort of directly address the media and answer those tough questions?
I think it's going to be a problem for media like us, but it's not going to be a problem for the rest of America. And look, I mean, she was only nominated, as we were saying, a few weeks ago. So she's getting her foot, and she's defining herself to the American people. And it's not like she's not talking to America. I mean, she's going directly to voters, to everyone. And so, no, I don't see that as a big problem. And I mean, Phil is right in terms of the criticism about her policy agenda, the first big ones that she outlined last week. But just look at her counterparts. And, you know, before I go there, I do want to say, yes, of course, you know, both candidates need to have a policy and agendas, and both agendas should be scrutinized very carefully by the American people, including us. But look at Donald Trump. I mean, all he has done is demonize her, attack her race, attack her laugh, her persona. So is that the agenda that we are okay with?
Let me bring this back to the conversation about the protests that could happen in Chicago this week, where I think expecting more pro-Palestinian protesters probably outside of the Democratic National Convention this week. Phil, do you think that that's going to be a sticking point, maybe not with the media or on the right, but on the left for Harris?
It could be a problem for her. It's challenging because these pro-Palestinian protests, They've already brought down three university presidents, the latest being the president of Columbia University. They could, in fact, be a problem at the convention.
Elvia, what's your take here in terms of Harris's messaging on the war in Gaza and how the Democratic Party, and particularly the center kind of left Democratic Party under Joe Biden, has dealt with it?
Well, very delicate. And I think that's what she has done. I mean, I'm not worried about the protest itself, and no one should be. I mean, what's democracy without allowing dissent, right? I mean, and we know democracy is messy. What I'm worried about is, you know, if violence breaks out on the streets. And I think, you know, Chicago, the city of Chicago has been rejecting a lot of permits precisely because they don't have the capacity to deal with that. So that's what I'm worried about, not what they're going to say in the message that they bring to the convention and to the administration. Look, it is important. We must talk about what's going on in the war. And eventually, both Trump and Harris must deal with it. You know, this is not going to go away. You know, Israel is an important ally to the United States, and what's happening there is very risky. You know, it could expand. That's what a lot of people are going to be looking at, you know, whether it's peaceful or relatively peaceful demonstrations. Mm-hmm. And again, no one should be afraid of peaceful demonstration and dissent. I mean, that's what democracy is all about.
Here's the real danger for Democrats. Mm-hmm. If those protests get out of control, they're going to underscore something that is a real weakness for both Kamala Harris and for her running mate. And that is that they were pretty much asleep at the wheel during the 2020 riots. Kamala Harris was out there helping to raise money for the lawbreakers who were, you know, needed to be bailed out of jail, or who she wanted to bail out of jail and to go back on the streets. And then her running mate sat on his hands as governor of Minnesota for 2 days as the mayor of Minneapolis begged for help in putting down the riots. They needed National Guard there, and they didn't get them for 2 days. So.
All right. And let me remind you, Lauren, that even Donald Trump was praising walls, you know, and the clips are there for everyone to see. I mean, back then with the riots, what the Phil was talking about, he specifically said the governor was doing a great job. So there it is. That is not to minimize, you know, the seriousness of any possible out of control rioting that may occur or may not, hopefully not, you know, in Chicago. But again, there's a lot of rhetoric going on.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. Elvia Diaz, Phil Boas with the Arizona Republic joining us. Thank you both, as always. Always appreciate these conversations.
Hey, thanks.
You bet.
What do you think of when you hear the word ozone? For many of us, it brings to mind the early days of our cultural awareness about climate change. In the 1980s, scientists discovered a hole in the ozone layer. Ozone, we learned back then, is a gas floating in the stratosphere that helps protect us from the ultraviolet rays of the sun. But it turns out there's also a lower altitude version of ozone. Armin Sarusian is a professor who researches ozone at the University of Arizona. And earlier this summer, he told the show's Sam Dingman that this lower altitude version of ozone is much less friendly.
Down low, near the surface, where we, you and I, everyone else, where we're walking, living, ozone has harmful effects because if we inhale it, it is an irritant. It's bad for our lungs. You know, it could lead to coughing, scratchy throat, could lead to long-term effects like emphysema, chronic bronchitis. It could lead to asthma attacks.
Yeah. So part of the reason we're talking today is because the American Lung Association just released its State of the Air report. And with that, there was the list of most polluted cities. Phoenix was number 5 on that list. And with one exception, New York, all of the other cities on that list, so 24 of, I believe, the top 25, were either in the West or the Southwest. What is it about this region of the country that makes us so susceptible to this low-altitude ozone that can get into our lungs?
So it really helps to know how you form ozone in the atmosphere. There's a few basic ingredients. You need sunlight, and you need two other types of chemicals, which are referred to as precursor species. And they are considered to be NOx, which is a, you know, fancy acronym that represents what we call nitrogen oxides, and then VOCs, which are volatile organic compounds. NOx and VOCs are emitted from all kinds of sources around us. It could be from human-made activities like cars, industries, or wildfires. And VOCs, similarly, can come from natural sources too. Like one of the largest sources of VOCs is actually vegetation. And then the fuel to really generate the ozone is sunlight. And so that's something we have a lot of, especially in the summertime and in the middle of the days here in the Southwest.
Gotcha. And whenever I hear a story in the news about climate peril, I am tempted to ascribe the basis for that peril to people being irresponsible, generally speaking. We're building too much, we're driving too much, we're using too many dangerous chemicals in our manufacturing, whatever the case may be. But if I'm hearing you right, while that may be playing some of a role here, the bigger factor is just that we live in a region that is uniquely predisposed to the formation of ozone.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, if it was easy enough to just know what knobs to turn to reduce the ozone levels, it would have been done by now. It hopefully allows people listening to appreciate the complexity of ozone formation. In big cities like Phoenix and Tucson, other ones across the western U.S., it turns out on the weekend, you might actually have higher ozone. We have fewer people outside driving, so there's less NOx emissions. But this leads to the nonlinear factors leading to ozone. It turns out in big cities, if you have less pollution from things like vehicles, your ozone can actually go up. So the research we're doing, you know, at the university level, we're looking at sort of the day of week trends of ozone. And in Phoenix, for instance, Sunday typically has the highest ozone. And that's why it's so hard to know the best mitigation strategies right now to cut down the ozone. There's a lot of factors outside of our control.
Boy, you know, this is a more unnerving conversation than I was realizing it was going to be, because, again, you know, with a lot of climate stories, even if there's not much hope that humans will adopt on a mass scale the kind of changes we need to mitigate other forms of destructive behavior that lead to climate change, at least a lot of times in those conversations, you can come out feeling like, well, there are things we could be doing. But this is pretty fascinating that ozone seems to be this phenomenon that behaves in such unpredictable ways that not only is it very dangerous, but it is resistant to study because of its nonlinear or its volatile nature.
So we, our team at the U of A, myself and another professor, Ave Arellano, we've been looking at all the archived data that we can find across the state of Arizona that's been collected over the last few decades. And we're trying to use satellite data and advanced models. And so we've already been able to learn a little bit more about the temporal changes in ozone in different parts of Arizona across many years, and looking at different seasons of the year, different days of the week, different times of the day. And so we're making advancements in understanding, you know, when are the periods when ozone levels are the highest, which can help inform people, like when are the times to avoid being outside, especially if you're vulnerable. Populations that are most vulnerable to ozone are younger people, especially infants, because their lungs are still developing, and elderly people. So some of the results we've already published on help provide these details of when are the worst times to be outside. And also with all the modeling simulations we're doing, we're trying to advance our capabilities to forecast these sort of extreme ozone events.
Is that the best course of action if it is a particularly bad day or period or region for ozone, is to just stay inside?
That is probably the best strategy, yeah, because you want to avoid breathing any of the air outside and, you know, have good clean air in your homes, you know, with windows closed. That's probably a great strategy on the very high ozone days.
So if somebody's listening to this and they're thinking to themselves, oh my God, I didn't even know that this was something I should be mindful of. I wonder if today is a bad ozone day. I'm outside right now as I'm listening to this. Where do you recommend folks go to get an assessment of the current ozone levels and what actions they should take?
Yeah, so everyone walking outside, for instance, usually has a smartphone. And so, you know, if you just go to your weather app or any, there's so many apps now, there's an air quality index value that is provided. Like for me right now, I'm looking at my phone, I'm looking at my weather app, and there's an air quality index of 36 in Tucson as we speak, which is classified as good. The important thing to know is that, again, it's been around forever, and we're just only learning more about it because of our more advanced methods, which is only going to help us in the future.
Professor Armin Sarushian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. This week, we'll feature a handful of visits of world leaders to foreign countries. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Fruin in London. And Jonathan, let's start with Vietnam's leader, who will be visiting China on a state visit for the next couple of days. And this is his first overseas trip since he was also made Communist Party chief.
Yeah, that's right. The leader of the Communist Party is Vietnam's most powerful role, and President Tho Lâm was given the extra responsibility earlier this month following the death of the previous Communist Party chief, Nguyen Phu Chong, who died in July, aged 80, after holding the post of party secretary general for 13 years. Now, when he was elevated to the role of Communist Party Secretary General, Tho Lâm said he would accelerate his predecessor's fight against corruption. The popular anti-graft campaign known as Blazing Furnace has led to a series of upheavals recently, with numerous ministers, business leaders, and two former presidents all falling from grace. China and Vietnam had pledged to strengthen their bilateral ties after China's President Xi Jinping visited Vietnam last December, which was his first visit to the country in 6 years. That visit came after US President Biden's own visit to Vietnam last September, during which the two countries upgraded diplomatic ties. Vietnam pursues a policy of what's sometimes described as bamboo diplomacy, in which it tries to stay on good terms with both China and the US. And Vietnam's relationship with China has been evolving recently as anti-Chinese policies have been implemented in a number of Western countries, including the US. Chinese manufacturers have been shifting production to Vietnam in a bid to bypass US economic policies that are seen as hostile towards China and have been imposing something of a brake on the Chinese economy.
Well, so what is on the agenda then during Tho Lâm's visit to China?
Well, one key issue is related to the production shifts from China to Vietnam, a bid to try and improve rail ties between the two countries. Seamless rail links are seen as crucial for supply chains as Chinese companies shift their export operations to Vietnam to circumvent restrictions on Chinese exports. The countries are connected by two railways from southern China to Vietnam's capital, Hanoi, and its northern industrial hub. But the Vietnamese infrastructure dates back to French colonization and has a different gauge to Chinese high-speed rail. So that means passengers and goods are forced to swap trains at the border. On his visit in December, President Xi offered grants and loans to help upgrade Vietnam's railways, and that was helped by joint pledges to boost railway cooperation. So likely progress towards bringing all of that into reality. But Vietnam needs to tread relatively carefully because back in 2018, there were protests in the country over plans that could have led to closer economic ties with China. And it will certainly be interesting to see how the Tho Lâm visit to China plays out.
Indeed. All right. So, Jonathan, staying with the visits by visiting leaders, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is expected to head to Poland and Ukraine later this week. Why is this significant?
Well, a trip to Ukraine by Narendra Modi comes just weeks after he paid a visit to Vladimir Putin in Russia, which was criticized at the time by Ukraine's President Zelensky. He described it as a, quote, huge disappointment and a devastating blow to peace efforts to see Narendra Modi with what he called the world's most bloody criminal in Moscow. While significant sanctions were put on trade with Russia by Western countries following Vladimir Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, India and China have continued to trade with Russia, getting access to much cheaper oil than they'd be able to pick up on world markets. Meanwhile, India has declined to directly blame Russia for its invasion of Ukraine, while urging the two countries to resolve their conflict through dialogue and diplomacy. But sort of underscoring the sensitivity of issues around Ukraine, during Prime Minister Modi's visit to Moscow, a Russian-made missile strike hit a hospital in Kyiv, killing dozens of people. At the time, Narendra Modi told Vladimir Putin that the death of innocent children was, quote, painful and terrifying. So this trip to Ukraine is a chance for Narendra Modi to try and repair his relationship with Volodymyr Zelensky.
And Jonathan, am I right that Modi's visit to Poland is the first such visit by an Indian leader in more than four decades?
Yeah, that's right. The last Indian leader to visit Poland was Morarji Desai back in 1979. And that's despite the fact that Poland is India's largest trade and investment partner in Eastern Europe. Narendra Modi will have meetings with both Poland's president, Andrzej Duda, and Prime Minister Donald Tusk. Defence and strategic alignment are top of the agenda, but the leaders will also have a focus on technology collaboration. Poland has fairly advanced technology in the food processing industry, and it's thought one outcome of meetings could be the establishment of mega food parks in India. India's investment in Poland has been growing fairly steadily over the years and is now thought to be worth more than $3 billion. Meanwhile, India's IT companies are big investors and are estimated to employ nearly 10,000 Polish nationals. But there's no doubt that Narendra Modi will need to tread a fine line in the coming week, particularly around his visit to Ukraine.
Interesting. All right, Jonathan. Finally, tomorrow on Tuesday, Thailand's new prime minister will be holding her first cabinet meeting. It has been quite a tumultuous few days for Thai politics. Can you bring us up to speed on that?
Yeah, it certainly has. Last Wednesday, Thailand's constitutional court dramatically dismissed Setha Tawisin as prime minister. The court accused him of gross violation of ethics for appointing a lawyer to his cabinet who had served time in jail. The next day, the biggest party in Thailand's coalition government, Pheu Thai, nominated the 37-year-old Paetong Tan Chinawat as its pick for Setha Tawisin's replacement, which was confirmed by Parliament on Friday morning. She's the youngest person ever to be Thailand's prime minister and is the daughter of the former prime minister Thaksin Chinawat. She's become quite a familiar figure in Thailand since leading her party in the general election last year, proving a popular campaigner, speaking at rallies up to the last month of pregnancy with her second child. But her family, in particular her mother, who is still a powerful figure in the Pheu Thai party, did not want her to become prime minister. She feared that she would be vulnerable to the kinds of legal interventions that forced both her father, Thaksin Chinawat, and her aunt Yingluck Chinawat, who was Thailand's first female prime minister, from office. The unexpected court ruling that brought down the premiership of Setha Tawisin, though, forced the family's hand, because aside from the former prime minister, Pheu Thai had just two other registered candidates eligible to replace him, the new prime minister or an elderly former prosecutor who the party's MPs believe didn't quite have the energy or charisma to lead them into the next election, which is due in 3 years' time.
Yeah, that is interesting. Lots to keep our eyes on there. All right. That is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. Jonathan, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you, too. Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. And joining me now in studio is the show's Sam Dingman. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, guys. So last Friday marked the release of the first new album in 8 years from the folk rock band Blind Pilot. The record is called In the Shadow of the Holy Mountain. And for lead singer Israel Nebeker and Tucson-based drummer Ryan Dabrowski, it's a big moment. As Nebeker and Dabrowski told me on the phone last week, this album is very much a product of the COVID-19 pandemic. In the midst of separation and lockdown, they both found themselves reconsidering their relationship to music.
And in that time, I really started to turn my focus back towards painting. And that was great. You know, it was just a real quiet, sort of solitary outlet for me.
Yeah. Israel, how about for you?
My main thing is Blind Pilot, so I haven't been doing anything except for just, you know, trying different ways to write songs. I just kind of was struggling to write for a few years and then had some breakthroughs.
Tell me about those breakthroughs. What changed?
It's a mysterious thing. Like, I was, I will absolutely do my best to explain it, but I know that I don't understand it completely. Songwriting, like most artistic endeavors, is a conversation with a deeper or higher source or self. And it just wasn't, that channel wasn't wanting to be open and songs weren't wanting to come through. And I tried a lot of things that were very like deliberate and direct about songwriting. I pivoted at some point and just started improving myself and my life, and I just found that the songs kind of showed up and said, okay, now we'll come through. This is a safe place for us to be.
You know, you're making me think of, I used to be an actor, and you're making me think of one of my favorite acting exercises, which was, you know, if you were trying to conjure a certain amount of emotion in a scene, instead of just trying to think about a time you cried. You should think about the room that you were in when you started crying and just try to get a tangible sense in your memory of the physical characteristics of the room, and that would prompt the emotion. And I feel like I hear some of that in what you're describing with this songwriting process.
Yeah, that feels right on to me. It's a difference between, I think, in our language that we have for creating, our language often revolves around the notion of artifice and craft and what we can force and make to happen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what you're describing, I hear a lot of trust in that if you tap into the right space, the right thing will happen. And that's definitely how songwriting feels to me.
Hmm. Ryan, for you, when it comes to painting and drumming, do you feel as an artist any connection between those two practices?
I'm not a terribly busy drummer. Like I like to play to the song and mm-hmm. the strength of the song, and I take a similar approach in painting. Like I don't try to overfuss with details. I've tried many things from the time when I started painting, and for, you know, a while it was similar to drumming, I guess. You know, you just want to see like how far you can push your technical skills. And so, you know, I was doing almost photorealist work for a bit, but even though it was technically maybe impressive, it didn't feel right to me.
Yeah. I'm looking at one of your paintings right now, which I think is called Winter Sun. And there's these big swaths of kind of a golden yellow, for example, and then sort of a bluish color in the background. And it's painted in this repeated set of what look to be very small strokes. And it's really interesting to hear you describe incorporating rhythm into your painting and then imagining you rendering those strokes in a rhythmic fashion. Is that a fair inference to make?
Yeah, for sure. And that repetition sort of becomes almost trance-like within the paintings. It sort of creates this visual vibration.
Uh-huh. Something I feel like I hear you both talking about a lot is either coming into, for the first time, or perhaps returning to a sense of trust in your creative intuition. Is that something that feels fresh or like a rediscovery, or is that something that you've both always trusted throughout your musical careers?
I feel like I've held that concept throughout my time writing songs, mm-hmm. but it's a funny thing because you hit something good, it resonates with you, you're so happy that it came to you and through you, and then you just want to do that again. So you try to like make it happen. And then you have to remind yourself again and again, like, no, that's not how it came. I wasn't trying to do that. I was listening.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you both about some of the lyrics on the new record that were really resonant to me. The first one is, what can you do with a heart you will lose? Tell me a little bit about what's behind that sentiment for you.
I think when I wrote that song, I was at a spot where I was teaching myself how to play banjo.
Uh-huh.
My dad played the banjo. My great-grandfather played the banjo. I have all these banjos that I inherited. And so I was thinking about things that stay. And I also was in a time of transition and losing a relationship. And I was thinking about things that we're all bound to lose, acknowledging everything you come from, everything that will continue after you. And you get this time, and what are you going to do with it? It was in that spirit.
Yeah.
That line came.
But that's really lovely. And I mean, if I'm not mistaken, the continuation of that lyric is, what can you do with a heart you will lose? I want to see what you can do.
What can you do? Can you do with a heart you will lose? What can you do? Can you do how I want to see what?
I was very moved by that, and it felt of a piece with a couple of other lyrics from the record. One is, fire is warm, but it burns fast. On those songs, and really throughout the record, a sense of kind of the fleetingness of experience.
I definitely have been in an experience in the past year or two of being in that place of noticing how the things that feel permanent and tangible in this life seem to really take me out of being present with truly permanent things. Things like our stories, our lineage, the things I stress about and worry about take me out of that actual permanence.
Ryan, I'm curious for you as a drummer, when you're listening to the songs that Israel brings in and you guys are developing them together, how much are you thinking about themes or emotional content in terms of how it informs your playing? Is that something that you're consciously doing, or are you listening more rhythmically and musically?
Yeah, I mean, certainly Israel's vocal delivery usually echoes the sentiment of the lyrics. So you can sort of fall into that and create this atmosphere around the vocal. And as a drummer, that's the main thing that I listen to.
This is really fun for me to hear about. We never talk about this stuff. We've never had a conversation in the band where it's like, what's this song about? Like, it's just never come up. And yet you know it on an intuitive level, even if you can't pinpoint why it feels that way.
That fire's warm, but it sure burns fast. Gonna stand where I see.
Well, Ryan Dabrowski and Israel Nebaker are two of the members of Blind Pilot. Their new album is In the Shadow of the Holy Mountain. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right, that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.